Could we get like a like one of those cleaning solution carts? You know, those little like Rubbermaid carts?
Yeah.
And could we be filming the spinning globe and then you push me on the cart and I'm like laying on the cart like Superman? Could we quickly do that? Or it would look like I'm flying by the Daily Planet sign?
And then you realize that it was actually the security guard that pushed you out the door.
All right, so hey kids, how's about we start 101?
It's exciting.
It's On Taking Pictures, episode 101, which means where you are, hopefully it's still Tuesday. And if it's Wednesday or Thursday, then you are far too busy and you need to dump some things from your schedule so you can listen on Tuesdays.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because this is important.
More important than anything else.
That's true. My name is Jeffrey Sidoris from fadedandblurred.com, which I think today or tomorrow we will be returning with our spotlights.
Okay, you know, that's exciting.
The big spotlight features.
Are you going to give a little tease?
I'm not even going to tease you. I'm going to tell you who it is.
What?
Salgado is our next spotlight.
Ah.
Fascinating life. Brilliant photographer. I think Millie even suggested doing him. Sebastio Salgado, photographer extraordinaire, will be the next spotlight on Faded and Blurred. And with me, Mr. Bill Wadman.
How you doing, Jeffrey?
At the other end of the lens.
You know, it's funny because I was on another podcast on Saturday.
Oh, God. Here we go again.
Where we discussed Cosmos. It was fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a thing about that that we'll get to.
Cosmos?
Just hold your horses, mister.
Okay, my horses are being held.
Let's get the group business out of the way.
Okay, yeah.
Close-up was the last assignment, and I feel like I should just record this and then just press the button every week. Yeah. You guys killed it.
Soundboard.
Yeah, yeah. Beep. You guys killed it.
Yeah.
Beep. But you really did. There are some really fantastic shots up there for close-up. People are still putting in some of the previous assignments, which is great. I really like that. And I like the variety, color, black and white. You guys are putting up different types of subject matter. It's not there's some really, really some great stuff. So thank you for the participation and keep them going. Let's see. Was there one that I really wanted to
highlight?
No, I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
But suffice to say there is some really wonderful work up there. So this week, your challenge, should you, what? Wow. Look at that. Thanks, Brian, for the walker / toilet.
Yeah.
That's
it. I saw that one. What's this week?
This week, we want you to get your blurry on. And this one is bokeh. Or if you're a fan of Kai Wong on Digital Rev, bokeh!
Oh, wait, I know that guy.
Yeah.
I Kai like Wong. That guy.
Yeah, he's funny.
He's silly. Yeah, I like that
yes,
guy.
Yes, he is. Bokeh is, or bokeh, is this week's assignment. So open up those lenses, ladies and gentlemen, and let's see what you got.
All right.
Some really great stuff. Hey, you know what? This is down on the thing, but I'm calling an audible. I'm calling an audible, man.
Okay.
Group member and listener, Fred Levy is all over the place this week.
Doing what?
With his Black Dog project.
Oh yeah.
Fred, congratulations, man. I am so proud of you. It's so great. Fred, for those of you who don't know, does a project photographing black dogs.
And they're okay? Super cute.
They are. And Fred's stuff got posted on Huffington Post.
HuffPo.
Which then got him to Upworthy, which then got him to Petapixel. I mean, yeah. Thousands of people liking it, probably hundreds of thousands of people looking at it.
I'm going to come steal Denver. The
way to go,
Black
Fred.
Lab.
Really, really cool. Really proud of you. It's a great project.
Yep.
Well deserved. And you know how he got it? You know how he got on HuffPo?
How did he do that?
He asked.
Yeah, that's what happens.
So let it not be said that, you know, asking doesn't yield fruit.
All of these people need content.
I think that's a little dismissive. You can't just you're not going to read. That's like saying, oh, well, if it's kids or dogs, then no.
What I'm saying is that, like, newspapers and websites, like, they, you know, require information to post. So, yeah, send your stuff in, because a lot of times they're like, wow, that's really great. We're going to put it up. That's what I'm saying. It wasn't dismissive.
Okay.
That was a pro.
Don't make me walk upstairs, mister. Don't even think about it.
I'd like to see you try to walk across the country to slap now, me.
So this gets us to another thing. You've been a little cranky lately. In fact, you've been a lot cranky lately. What is your thing about you just leave us alone and die with Upworthy and BuzzFeed? What is this? What do you got going?
I'm sick and tired of Buzz. You know what it is? I'm sick and tired of the. These are five great ways you're going to see people, you know, love each other, you know, like all these ridiculous.
Wait, what?
that's a different kind of site.
Hold on.
No, you know, like,
kids.
I'm just sick of top 10 lists and how they are every fourth post in my Facebook feed now lately, you know.
You know, there's an unsubscribe button, number one.
Yeah, but I don't want to unsubscribe to those people. You know what I mean? It's not Upworthy putting them in. It's
but
like my.
How is that any? How is doing? So you're saying it's link bait?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Okay. So how is that any different than Carl Sagan versus Neil deGrasse Tyson? Isn't that link bait for the geeks? Yeah. How is that any different?
Well, we're spending an hour discussing that. I just think that a lot of those things. Oh, come on. You're going to try to you're going to sit there and defend like most of those Upworthy posts.
I like Upworthy. I get a lot of enjoyment out of it.
Okay.
Starts my day out with a smile.
Okay. Yeah. Those
sometimes
I'm just bored of I'm sick of the lists. Top 10, this top five, this.
Yeah, but when you say
five,
things like
four things
like,
you have never thought about
and leave me alone, that comes off as
what? Cranky?
Probably not cranky. Yeah. Get off my lawn. I mean, crankier than me even.
Yeah. I don't know if that's possible,
but I'm not cranky.
I'm just sick of those lists. It makes me not want to go to Facebook because like half my things are those lists, but whatever. It's all right. What are we talking about today? Lots of
well,
stuff.
Well, apparently there's another podcast out there.
Yeah, there is. I like this new podcast. You know, this podcast came up because, I was doing research, or Heather was doing research for the other show, and found an interview with James Burke, who's like one of my favorites, the guy who did Connections back in the 70s.
Right.
And,
yes. Right.
It was, well, originally it was on BBC, right? And,
came here on PBS though. Yeah.
Yeah. It was on PBS and Learning Channel, and yeah, it was on all kinds of things. Probably PBS back when,
before the Learning Channel was,
when we saw it, yeah, it was on PBS
reality TV.
God, it's so awful. And so I started listening to this guy's podcast, and it's a boing boing podcast called, You Are Not So Smart.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically, I think you would really like it because it's interesting. He takes a topic and,
but I am so smart. So I already take umbrage with it.
he takes a topic and he does like a little 10-minute monologue before he actually brings the guest on to discuss whatever it is they're going to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
And like he brought James Burke on to talk about like the future and how humans are really bad at predicting the future. And he did an episode with this psychologist who talks about, you know, spending money and what the better things to spend money on as far as return of investment on happiness and that kind of stuff, which was pretty
chocolate,
interesting.
Ice cream.
Yeah.
Waffles.
All food for you, huh?
Donuts.
Donuts aren't food.
Specifically Pip's Donuts in Portland.
Yeah, I've heard those are good. I'm going to...
Pip's Original.
Next time I get there, I'm going to have to try them.
You will not be sorry. Anyway, go ahead.
And anyway, so one of the episodes that I downloaded and was listening to was about selling out and the concept of selling out, which has been a topic on our show since time immemorial, right?
Right.
And what was interesting about it was that apparently the next generation below me, two or three generations below you, doesn't know what sellout means. Like, if you say to, apparently, if you say to like a 20-year-old, like, what does sellout mean? They don't know. A lot of them don't know what it means because it's not inside their vocabulary. It's not inside their zeitgeist, right? Which
could be a good thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just interesting that that term and that whole thing is very much of a certain generation, which mm-hmm. you wouldn't think that it would be, right? And this guy goes and interviews this, you know, psychologist guy who wrote some book and talks about the whole concept of selling out and that, you know, they talk about it as the pump of capitalism. So, you know, people in some town don't like whatever the big mainstream bands are. So they spend their time trying to find these sort of indie bands and whatever it is. And they tell their friends about it and they start going to the shows. And then the indie band starts getting more of a following. And then, oh, they get a record deal. And oh, they go on tour with some big mainstream band and they are mainstream themselves. And all of a sudden the fans are like, no, they've sold out. They're mainstream. And they dive back down to the bottom to find the next new thing. Right. And his point is that capitalism requires those people because they're the engine. They're the beginning of the engine that like pulls the stuff up from the bottom. And that the whole idea of like authenticity is really just a word for status, you know, that you want to be authentic by using these materials or eating these kinds of food or whatever it is. But that exclusivity is all about that I'm better than you are. And that's what it's all about, is this guy's argument.
That's ridiculous.
You think it's ridiculous? I thought it was fascinating.
So to be authentic is really only a status symbol?
That there's no such thing as authenticity. That everything's authentic. That's ridiculous. Everything is what it is. So by definition, it is authentic.
I don't think that's true. I know people that only wear certain kinds of clothing. They only shop certain places. They only go to certain restaurants.
Yeah. And they're what?
Is that authentic?
Well, no. Well, they think that they're doing something different, right? That's why they go to those places and do those things. Or take those pictures or use that camera in our parlance.
You know? Maybe.
You know? And so they think that they are better because they do something different than the mainstream.
But how is that authentic or inauthentic? Where is the connection there?
Well, the word authenticity has basically taken the place of the word cool of 20 years ago. You know, that things aren't cool anymore. They're like real and authentic. And
I don't know. Kids smoke cigarettes to look cool. I don't know that they smoke cigarettes to look authentic.
Yes. But they do other things to be authentic. They, you know, like build their own furniture in their house and all that, you know, whatever the new thing is, you know, he's saying that it's funny that the hipster subclass, as he puts it, is, you know, very similar to the, you know, the hippies back in the day and the anti-globalization people in the 90s, like where it's like the new counterculture. He says the interesting thing about the latest counterculture of the so-called hipsters is that they're not political in the way that past ones were. You know, it's fascinating. He says, you know, that people wanted organic foods, and then because that was outside of the world of you know, corporate, this, that, and the other thing. And of course, then Walmart starts selling organic foods at like 10% over the cost of other foods. And now they want locally grown. Well, you know, apparently locally grown meat has been in such dire, demand in cities that they can't make enough, say, meat to serve, say, New York City, right? So they will take locally grown cows, like cows out in New Jersey, but there aren't enough places to actually abattoirs, you know, to like cut the meat down and right, kill the animals. Right. So they'll ship the animals states away to get slaughtered and then ship the meat back and then sell it in New York as locally grown meat, even though the whole point of locally grown is that you don't use all the carbon to take it from one place to the other because they can't,
right.
You know, there's like all these sort of like strangely hypocritical, crazy things going on. But really, people are doing it in a way to differentiate themselves from other people. Like it's all a status thing. I found it. It's a really interesting thing,
I get very disheartened with the idea of authenticity as simply a lifestyle accessory.
Yeah, but you know what, if you really think about it, what, look, I am generally the person who sits on here and rails against not selling out, but just sort of like, you know, that there are things that I don't like to do. Right. And I think that's a perfectly valid thing. But I used to use the term, not authenticity, but that, how do I put this? It's very difficult to put.
And I think it means different things in different contexts.
It does.
Are we talking about authenticity of how you present your life, how you live your life, how you approach your art, how you parent your children, how you choose
all
your
of those
music?
Things. Right. Why is one thing better than another when talking about how you choose your music? You know, maybe you like Justin Bieber. Why is there something wrong with that? Why is that less cool?
Because Justin
or
Bieber sucks.
Okay. There you go. But you know what I mean? Like, he says in the thing, he's just like, what if you really love the movie Titanic and you like it for completely organic reasons? You just like the movie, but it happens to be the multi-billion-dollar thing. You like Titanic?
Right. Yeah,
you know,
I like it.
Right.
No, I liked it.
You know.
It's a great summer movie.
Right. But there's a lot of people who are just like, ugh, you like Titanic?
The ending threw me for a loop, but...
Yeah. I just find the idea
it
of...
It sunk?
You know,
damn.
Like, some people would say, you know, I like to use, say, an SLR camera, right? And everyone says, oh, well, the new world is EVFs and you're going to have to deal with it, Wadman. And some people are just like, you just like... optical viewfinders because you're old or you're curmudgeonly or, you know, whatever reason, or you want to think that you use a camera that's fancier or better than, you know, the EVF, you know, your iPhone or whatever it is.
Well, and to be sure, there are people out there that are using certain cameras because they are status symbols.
Sure.
They are lifestyle accessories.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
Bruce Springsteen,
everybody who bought a Lunar.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that is, and that's always been. There are people that wear certain kinds of shoes because they are status symbols. There are people that drive certain types of vehicles. You know,
But you even, when we were discussing that Jack White interview last week or 2 weeks ago, and he said, I think, stop worrying about authenticity. It's a waste of time or it doesn't exist or something along those lines. Do you remember what his exact words are?
I don't remember the exact words, but I do
like
remember
that.
Saying that, and I don't agree with it.
You don't
I do
agree
think
with it.
There is genuine
so
authenticity.
So what is authenticity then?
I think it is, at least in part, living your life without external pressures.
See, it's really hard to do.
Living your life without caving to the pressures of the status quo.
Okay, but... Well,
you know?
That's making a judgment on that the status quo, there's something wrong with the status quo.
I think in some cases there is.
Right. But that's your personal
right. So,
view.
So authenticity is a personal statement. And I think it's been usurped as this sort of cultural mindset, you know, that authentic people have been usurped almost as a way of defining a cross section of people like hipsters or something. And I don't agree with that. I think authenticity is personal. It's like religion or politics. It's they're your personal sort of views of how you view yourself and the world around you.
But in that sense, everyone is authentic.
No, they're not.
They're not. So you're saying that more authentic than the next guy because.
How many teenagers go through a rebellious period and they want to be different, so they start wearing, you know, goth clothes and makeup, and it's like, well, now you're not different. You're like every other rebellious teenager that went through that particular type of phase. That's not different. That's not unique.
Yeah, but
you may think that that's unique, but it's not.
Right. Well, I think that that's the case with a lot of other things where people think they're authentic too, you know?
How many people buy a 5D3 because that's what, you know, some wedding photographer they saw uses, or that's what you use, or whatever, when that's not what they need? You don't need a 5D3.
Right.
Who are you kidding? You could shoot the pictures that you shoot with a Rebel. You're not fooling anybody, but you like the way it feels. It works for you.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. If you bought it because somebody else has it and you want to be like that person and you're mistakenly thinking that that makes a difference, then that's inauthentic.
Yeah, I think
you know. I wear Lee jeans. I eat at Chipotle. I drive a Honda Fit. You know, who am I trying to impress? Nobody.
And doing a great job at it.
And doing a great job. But you know what? I was in that world for a while where you had to eat at certain places and you had to spend this much money and you had to dress this way.
Sure.
And you am I being authentic because that's what the people around me were doing, but I was hating every minute of it?
Yeah, but some of those people, for them, that was their authentic position. Maybe it was just the wrong thing for you.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But you saying know. That authenticity doesn't exist,
he's you know the one of the
silly.
Well, one of the points that he makes is that the you know there's always further afield. You know, if you like this really underground band and some other guy comes over and he likes those same underground bands, then you're going to try to find an even more underground band to like.
Yeah.
You know,
how many people loved Pearl Jam before they made it?
Right,
and then when they made it, they're like, oh man, Pearl Jam.
That's exactly.
Okay, well, thing, right? You know what. They started a band to make a living as a band.
Right.
And then when they finally were able to do that, now you're going to slight them for it?
Yeah, he plays this clip of Bill Hicks, you know, the comedian.
Yep, sure.
You know, railing against these, you know, any...
Which there's a great documentary on Netflix about him, by the way.
Oh, is there? I haven't seen it.
Yep.
But, you know, any performer who gets up and shills for some company is automatically outside of the artistic realm and forever. Like, you shill for a company once, your art is meaningless.
Okay, so John Lennon's art is now meaningless because Nike used his music in an ad.
Well, I don't think that he chose that because he was dead by that point. But if John Lennon had done that, then yes, according to Bill Hicks. Now, Bill Hicks, of course, died at, 32? So right. he never got old enough to have to worry about having enough money to survive or, right. You know, whatever. And apparently George Carlin back in the 80s or something did an ad for some telephone company. And everyone said, oh, George Carlin sold out, whatever it is. And George Carlin in his bio talks about how he was under the thumb of the IRS for a lot of money. And that was the only way he could get out, mm-hmm. You know. And it's really interesting in the artistic world, what it means to be an authentic artist.
I mean, is Louis C.K. no longer a viable comedian because he's not struggling at the clubs every night because he just did SNL because he's got a successful show because blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, I don't know.
Did he sell out?
Right.
Did Dave Chappelle sell out? Chris Rock?
Yeah. I mean, no, well, Chappelle's a good example because, you know, to a lot of people, the fact that Chappelle walked away from whatever it was, like a $50 million deal to make more of the show or whatever it is. Remember when he kind of like lost his mind and disappeared?
Yep.
There's a lot of people who would probably say, oh, see, Chappelle's like for real because he didn't take
the
money.
I don't think it was some sort of value judgment.
No,
I think he snapped.
Right. But you understand what I'm saying is that there's some people who would say, ah, see, he's still real because he walked away from the man when the man threw money in his face.
I think a better example would be somebody like Michael Bay, who's churning out Transformers movies like they're chocolate chip cookies.
Yes. But don't you think that Michael Bay thinks his movies are good or is actually trying to make good movies?
I hope not.
See, that's, I remember when I was in, when I was at Berkeley,
I think he knows his audience. And I think in that respect, he's a great businessman.
Okay. Stephen King knows his audience.
Absolutely.
And
Stephen King is also an incredibly good writer.
Okay. Well, Michael Bay
Stephen
got
King,
somewhere,
Stephen
right?
Stephen King wrote the same types of things for years.
Yes.
Before he made it.
So you're saying Stephen King is more authentic of an artist than Michael Bay?
I mean, it's not for me to make that judgment, but I think Stephen King writes for himself. I don't think he writes for his audience. I hope that he doesn't write for his audience. I hope that he writes for himself. And we, as his audience, happen to come along for the ride.
Okay. Let's assume for the moment that that's true. Why is that better than him writing for his audience? What if he likes writing for his audience and that's what makes him happy? It's somehow better if he's writing for himself rather than his audience?
I guess that gets into the nature of art. And is art something you do for someone else?
Yeah.
Or is art something you do for yourself? Is craft something you do for yourself?
Yeah.
Or is craft something you do to impress your peers?
Is art more authentic when you're doing it for you rather than doing it for somebody else?
And that's, again, that gets us back to the personal yep. definition of authenticity.
Yep. Well, you know, okay. So when I was at Berkeley, I was in this class and somebody brought up, we were talking about, I think we were talking about selling out. This is, you know, the music industry, right? In the late 90s. So this is, and somebody brought up, I think Hootie and the Blowfish, because they were big
was
at the time.
Was it John Mayer that brought it up? Was John Mayer there? Did he bring it
John
up?
John Mayer was not in the classroom, but he was at school with me at the time. Yes. Somebody said, you know, Hootie and the Blowfish. And the guy said, do you have any idea how many gigs in crappy bars Hootie and the Blowfish have played in the last like 6 years that they've been together? You know?
Yeah.
He's just like, there's no, basically my teacher, who was like this hardcore, serious, you know, Grammy Award winning guy, he's just like, there's no such thing as selling out.
Right.
Like anybody who's gotten that far has gotten that far because they've worked really hard and they
played night after night of eight right. audience member shows.
Now, the same could be said of Michael Bay. Do you like no Michael Bay movies? You know, they make a lot of money for the studios, and people seem to want to see them. So why?
Yeah, but you can't use that argument that this escapism. I mean, just because something sells a lot doesn't mean it's good.
True.
Just because a lot of people buy something doesn't mean it's good.
No, it doesn't mean it's good. But like, what is good? You know, then if the definition isn't monetarily successful, then how do we define good at all?
I guess, I mean, yeah, some of his stuff is it's great popcorn movies.
Right.
They are great popcorn movies. I think it's more that I have a problem with, you know, Rocky 17
Transformers
and Transformers 7 blah, 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 blah. It just seems like you're mining the same well, and there's really no creative juice left in that well.
Yeah, I would be the first to agree with you a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And after listening to this podcast a couple times, it's like it's got me recalibrating, and I'm not sure exactly where I stand on this stuff.
I'll tell you what, I will listen to this. Okay. And we will revisit it next week.
Okay. I think there's...
Because I feel like I'm at a disadvantage because I have not listened to this same source material that you have.
It's perfectly fair. I just think that there's a really good discussion to be had about what authentic art even means, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, you and I sit here and we talk about how you need to take pictures, you know, that means something to you, you know, or sometimes when I say that I don't want to take X picture, you'll question me about that. You know, you'll push back a little bit and say, you know, why don't you try taking that picture? You know, whatever it is, right? You know, we have these discussions.
Right.
And whether you're shooting for a client or shooting the kind of work you don't like to do, a friend of mine, I met on a train a while back. He's a musician and he
Were
had
you strangers on a train.
Yeah, no. He had a teacher who said, never always decide what you think about the gig on your way home from the gig, not before it or okay. during it, you know, cause it may be something that you didn't expect, good or bad, you know what
sure.
I mean? Which I thought was kind of interesting.
I think that's great.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that there's a certain amount of challenge that needs to happen. Challenge to your soul, challenge to what makes you
yeah.
when you're creating anything.
Yeah. But do you and I, and I know this is opening up a slight can of worms and we could save it for next week, but do you and I give too much import to the magic of creation?
I don't think I do.
Okay.
Because without the magic of creation, it's just a mechanical process. And I find that disturbing. I find that disheartening.
Right. And I think that that's the...
I don't want to know the physical properties of lightning. I want to stand in awe beneath it.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
I don't want to reduce it to, you know, if they find the creativity gene... That, oh, well, some people have this gene and we can now synthesize it and blah, blah.
Jeffrey, they're called midichlorians.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, my, wasn't that a disappointment? Ugh. mystical force in the universe reduced to particles in your blood. Good job, George. Ugh. Anyway, no, I think that part of that sort of sublime side of life in I mean, it's sort of like creativity and love and romance and all of these things that I can't really explain how they work. I don't,
the mysteries of life.
I want to be I want to be humbled by them. Mm-hmm. I want to be at their feet, as it were.
Look, we started this show, you and I, by saying that I'm a romantic and, you know, all that stuff, right? I think I am too. And I want to feel that way, and I want to feel enraptured. You know, I want that buzz that I get when something I'm working on is really working, you know?
And you fall into the traps. I mean, you know, everybody does. You write the same manuscript over and over again. You take the same picture right. over and over again. You draw the same, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
You know? I mean, the challenge is when that spark of brilliance, wherever it comes from, goes off, most of the time it goes off in the periphery. Most of the time it's not right in front of you. And if you miss it, you got to wait for the next one.
Right. Well, does this bring us to our second topic?
What's the second topic?
Your book.
My book? Did I write a book?
No. You
know. Have I written a book? I think so. Yeah, it kind of gets us in there. I just finished The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield. And if you haven't read this book, I can't recommend it enough. In fact, if there are enough people that are interested in this, I thought it might be interesting, and we don't have to do this, but I thought it might be interesting to have kind of an OTP, you know,
book,
like a
club.
Like a discussion group around this book. And there are a couple other books that I've got either ordered or on my wish list that I think would be interesting for us to discuss. And maybe it's via Hangouts or maybe, I don't know, but if you're interested, if you think this would be something interesting after this, then, you know, either ping us on the Google Plus group, which is bit.ly/OTP group, and the OTP and the G are all capitalized. We'll put a link in the show notes. So the thing with this book is, it's called The War of Art, Break Through the Blocks and Win Your Inner Creative Battles, of which I have many. And it's a quick read. I read it.
Who is the battle against, between? You're battling yourself, or is it an external thing?
I think it really depends on your supporting belief system.
Okay.
He uses the word muse in it. He uses... angels. He uses resistance as a personification. Like there is an actual thing called resistance.
And how do you feel about that?
I think it's true. I think resistance comes in many forms. I think it comes in Facebook. I think it comes in the form of a peanut butter sandwich. I think it comes in the form of anything that distracts
you. Hold on a second. I need a peanut butter sandwich.
Exactly. That's resistance, right? He says in the book, resistance is the enemy within.
Yeah. I thought resistance was futile, but okay.
Well, it is. And this book has gotten me thinking on a lot of different, and it's, again, it's very quick. I read it in a couple sittings and it packs a punch.
Some more. What else you got?
One of the things it starts out with, if the muse exists, she does not whisper to the untalented.
Okay.
Which is going to, that could be a whole other show. That statement there, we could spend quite a bit of time on unpacking.
In fact, I think we should at some time. Yeah.
Yeah. What does talent mean and who decides whether you have it or not? Some of the things that I have written down
really,
from
the
it.
The muse just, decides.
That's right. Some of the things that I've written down from it. The more important a call or action is to our soul's evolution, the more resistance we will feel toward pursuing it.
That's interesting.
What finally convinced me to go ahead was simply that I was so unhappy not going ahead.
Yeah, there's a certain point at which not doing something is more painful than doing it.
Well, this is classic Tony Robbins, right? Yeah. This is classic NLP.
But that would be my question about it. Is it giving you anything other than cookie cutter wisdom?
I don't believe in cookie cutter wisdom, number one, because I think, you know, it's sort of when the learner is ready, the teacher will appear. Or maybe you heard it as you're not ready to hear it until you're ready to hear it.
Right.
You can glean wisdom, insight, forethought, creativity, you know, inspiration from a number of different sources. But that particular statement is, you know, I remember a Tony Robbins seminar where he said that, you know, he's like, look, there are two things that drive human behavior, pain and pleasure. And that's it. Everything that you do in your life can be boiled down to either the avoidance of pain or the pursuit of pleasure, period, whether it's emotional, physical, spiritual, etc. And in many cases, he echoes what Pressfield says, the lack of ability to move forward is because the pain of staying put has not yet toppled the pain of moving forward.
Right.
Whatever that pain may be. There are things about approach. To the amateur, the game is his avocation. To the pro, it's his vocation. And those are two very different things. The pro gets down to work. The pro doesn't wait for the right time.
The pro doesn't, you know, fetishize.
Right. He talks about, he quotes Somerset Maugham somebody asks him, do you write all the time, or do you write only when inspiration strikes? And Somerset Maugham says, I write only when inspiration strikes. Fortunately, she strikes at 9 p.m. or 9 a.m. every morning. You know, and there is a routine to Pressfield's work. He sits down, he writes. He sits down and does his job. He does his creative work, and neither fire nor flood keeps him from it.
Right. I mean, this is similar. I mean, the same thing Stephen King does the same. I mean, that's the argument, right? Like, if you're a writer,
sure,
sit down and write for 2 hours a day. You know, it's funny. There was a thing going around, I think it was on Upworthy, about how creative, like what different famous creative people have, how they've scheduled their day.
Yeah.
Did you see that article?
Yeah, okay. I have. In fact, there's another book that I'm reading that is all about the ritual of artists and the ritual of creatives. Right.
The thing is that I think those are one of those. I think that's one of those topics where, yes, it may be that so and so did it like this, but I don't think it's one of those things where you can copy what worked for somebody else.
I don't think you know? Can either.
And I don't think you can't if you have to force yourself into a routine like that, then I feel like there's something else amiss. You know,
I don't
see. I feel like
you did some of the best work that I've seen out of you when you were forcing yourself to work every day.
Yes, yes, yes. But I wasn't working at the same time every day. And that, I was getting to that what worked for me is saying by the time you go to bed tonight, you have to do X. It wasn't. Right. Every day at 10 a.m., I'm going to sit down and do X.
And I feel that that's
right,
great.
Right,
that's
right. Great. I'm just saying that I think that reading that Stephen King does it in the morning, and, you know, Joyce Carol Oates does it at night, or whoever, right? Right? That, like,
and that's what works for them.
Right, right. That those are fun anecdotes more than they are actual good advice for what you're trying to create. You have to find your own way of creating a pattern of creation.
Right.
Yeah.
I think you have to look at the underlying meaning, not the logistics.
Yep. Yes.
What are some of the things that he says? Nothing is as empowering as real world validation, even if it's for failure.
Interesting.
The most important thing about art is to work.
Yep.
Eternity is in love with the creation of time. That's a William Blake quote. Whatever you can do or dream, you can begin it. Boldness has genius, magic, and power in it. Begin it now. That's Goethe. Some of this is or can be interpreted as you said, cookie cutter wisdom. But there are reasons that we remember and still use these quotes hundreds or even thousands of years later. They have weight. They have import. Yep. They have juice. We know that if we embrace our ideals, we must prove worthy of them, and that scares the hell out of us.
All right, reread that.
We know that if we embrace our ideals, we must prove worthy of them, and that scares the hell out of
us. Yeah, that's the whole, if I try and fail, that's worse than having not tried at all.
Right. And there are some things here. A professional does not hesitate to ask for help, for example. Tiger Woods, the greatest golfer in the world, yet he has a teacher. He works with Butch Harmon. And Tiger doesn't endure the instruction or suffer through it. He revels in it. It is his keenest professional joy to get out there on the practice tee with Butch to learn more about the game he loves. Tiger Woods is the consummate professional. It would never occur to him, as it would to an amateur, that he knows everything or can figure everything out on his own. On the contrary, he seeks out the most knowledgeable teacher and listens with both ears. The student of the game knows that the levels of revelation that can unfold in golf, as in any art, are inexhaustible.
I wonder who writers go to. Like, if Pressfield is saying that, other writers?
Maybe.
You know, I did that the other day. I'm in the process of sort of building this little corner set piece thing to work in.
Right.
And I thought that I'd come up with a good way to do it with this fake Venetian plaster and it looks like it's going to work. But then on Friday night, I bumped into my friend Hannah, who makes sets for movies. Like she did the new Spider-Man movie that's coming out and that kind of stuff. She's like on the team that, you know, build me a subway station. And they go,
right.
You got it, sir. You know, and they go build a subway station. And I said, oh, I'm going to do this. And I showed her the picture. She goes, oh, you know what you should do? You really need to do like a 3-level patina with these washes and blah, 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 blah. And like what I was going to do suddenly became like,
finger painting.
Yeah. Because, I mean, of course, that's what she does. Like, that's, you know, and it's just, I love sucking people up like that. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
When it comes to new knowledge like that, I'm a sponge. Like, oh, really? Like, tell me how your world works. You know, teach me everything I could possibly learn in, you know, 4 hours. Just feed it to me, you know?
Yeah.
All right. So keep going.
Page 146. This is something that I've struggled with this idea for a while. And I think this is interesting. We are not born with unlimited choices. We can't be anything we want to be. We come into this world with a specific personal destiny. We have a job to do, a calling to enact, a self to become. We are who we are from the cradle and we're stuck with it. Our job in this lifetime is not to shape ourselves into some ideal we imagine we ought to be, but to find out who we already are and become it. If we were born to paint, it's our job to become a painter. If we were born to raise and nurture children, it's our job to become a mother. If we were born to overthrow the order and of ignorance and injustice in the world, it's our job to realize it and get down to business.
I like that.
I do too.
I guess the question I have with those statements is that who decides? Just you, right? You know,
who decides what you are?
What you're capable of.
Well, that's the trick, isn't it? Yeah. So I'm in this position of I'm, you know, it's sort of like, Michelangelo with David, you know, how do you sculpt David? Well, you just chip away everything that's not David.
Right.
So now, you know, this book has had a profound effect on me, oddly enough.
Yeah.
And maybe it's, are they things that I've never heard before? No, a lot of this stuff I have heard before,
sure.
But my antenna is pointed in the right direction.
You know, because there are times when you say things, you've said things like that before that, you know, like not everyone can do anything and those kinds of statements. Right.
Right.
My pushback on that is just that kind of statement can also be used to say to somebody, you're not good enough at this. You need to do something else.
What's wrong with that? Why spend a lifetime?
No. Hold on a second. I'm not talking about say me deciding I'm not good enough at playing jazz piano. Right.
Okay.
I'm saying somebody else says, Bill, you're not good enough at playing jazz piano. And the problem with that is that we have hundreds or thousands or millions of examples of people who, you know, have piles of letters from people saying they suck. And then suddenly they're world famous at whatever it is they do. So there's a lot of, I feel like the question of who you are and what you are can only be answered by yourself.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. So
I do believe that.
Yeah. So, but then again, maybe you're deluding yourself.
You're not going to practice your way to becoming Tiger Woods. Tiger Woods was better by three than most adults will ever be. Period.
Yes.
It was in him. But you will never practice your way to Mozart. I don't care how much you practice.
But
you will not do it.
Yeah, but at the same time, I feel like that precludes the person who works really hard at something and goes from being number 500 in the world to becoming number five in the world. You know?
Yeah, but something had to be there.
Yes, something has to be there to start.
You're never going to be Avedon, ever.
Right. Right. I will be me.
Right.
Very different than Avedon. I'm not trying to be Avedon. I'm trying to
be
Bill
Wadman.
Well,
I'm not saying you are. I'm not saying you are, but in the annals of photography, you're not going to get there.
See, I don't know that that's a really bad statement because how do you know? There's plenty of people who started their careers like late and became world famous. Who knows? I have no idea where my career is going to take me, and I am not going to put limitations on myself that way.
But you do put limitations on yourself because you approach your career, and you said this before, as you want to be hanging in a museum. You want to be remembered long after your death for your photography.
I don't know that I will be remembered, but I want to try to create stuff that reaches that goal. That's my end goal.
Why? Who cares?
Because I want to make stuff
concerned
that's
with
that
being
good.
The best. But that doesn't mean it's okay, good? You have railed against the curators that put things up in MoMA.
Yes.
It's in MoMA, but you've said it's not good. So how do you make that benchmark that if it's hanging in a gallery or a museum somewhere, that it's good?
I'm trying to make the stuff that if I went into a gallery or museum, I would think, wow, that's really great.
Yeah, but
that's
who are you?
I am Bill Wadman. Well, then who is Avedon? You know? Why are Tiger Woods and Avedon better than you or me?
Well, because Tiger Woods shoots like 800 and under par.
Yes, but he didn't when he was five.
No, he shot 9 under par or something.
You know what I'm saying? Like, it's like, you know, people, you have this stasis mentality, which is that people are what they are. They're never going to improve.
That's not true. That's not true at all.
Okay.
That is absolutely not true.
But you're putting a limitation on that improvement?
I believe, I think you, yeah, I am.
Okay.
I don't think... No matter how much I practice Olympic speed skating, I'm never going to be an Olympic speed skater.
Well, not at your age. You can't even walk.
Good point.
No, but yeah, okay. Yes. Olympic speed. Sure. And I can come up with 50 things that I could never do. You know, I saw six performances of Paul Taylor dance in the last 3 weeks. You know, my friends are up there and, you know, they are monsters at what they do. These people are world class. Yes. I will never be a professional modern dancer. Because I have a bad back and I can't even touch my toes. But that doesn't mean that I can't be that good at the thing that I am good at. You see what I'm saying? Yes, I will never be a race, you know, what am I really terrible at? I can't draw for crap.
Were you going to say a race car driver?
I was, but I could be a race car driver.
That's where you go?
You know.
NASCAR is where you go.
I'm
never going to be Jeff Gordon.
Yeah. You know, I can't draw. I can't paint. I don't have that gene or whatever it is. Right. Like, you know, as you were saying, right.
But in your worldview, you could practice your way to that.
I think I could get a lot better at drawing than I currently am.
And I'm not saying that that's not true.
Right.
I'm saying that at that level, at that sort of genius icon level.
Okay, first of all, I think that there are very few of those people, and I think that they are the minority of people that we know in each field. I don't think we've done 100 photographers of the week, right?
Well, yeah, sort of thereabouts. Yeah,
right. I don't think that I think that maybe there's a handful, maybe a dozen of those who were these weird protean genius people. Right. And even then, a lot of these super genius people end up being there was a I think is it an Outliers Gladwell book where he talks about, you know, like the smartest man alive who has like a 210 IQ and knows everything. And he works as like a bouncer at a bar because he can't hold a job. Right. You know,
right.
I think that there are two things that go to work here. There's talent and then there's really hard work to harvest that talent.
And I think there is a
continuum between both of those things. So a little bit of talent and a whole crap load of work can be as successful as a crap load of talent and a little bit of work and vice versa. And we have no idea what somebody is going to become. You know, anybody in our group could be the next Avedon in your parlance. I don't put it past them.
That's true. But I don't believe that it comes from practice alone. I think that there has to be something there.
Oh, practice alone, no. But I don't think that anybody who is doing it and working hard at it probably has an ability already, or else they wouldn't have started and enjoyed it. You know what I mean? I think part of what makes you enjoy the things that you do is that you have some sort of aptitude for them. You know, like, oh, maybe. I like this. I've got a thing. Look, I can draw. I'm going to keep drawing, and you know that drawing is going to make me a better artist, which is going to make me enjoy drawing more, which is going to make me a better artist, etc. You know. I don't know. I you and I can disagree on this. I don't like putting limits on myself or anybody else and say, you're never going to be this or you're never going to be that. Cause that's the same thing that people who are that were told, you know,
in some cases. Sure. Yeah. And I'm not saying I'm not saying that you can't be good or that you can't be excellent. I'm saying that at that magical level, something was there to begin with.
Yes, but I think that magical level is as much.
That's me also being romanticized by the process and being sort of, you know, humbled by the mystery.
Yes, well, I think that mystery, in the way that you see it, is often an illusion that you want to believe because that makes it more magical.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe.
By the way, I learned this week that taking pictures of pretty girls and putting them on places is what gets you the most likes.
Yeah.
It's so like, it's, you know, I need to take more pictures of pretty girls.
The fan is distracting.
Oh, I like the fan. The fan makes it for me.
Well, that's telling then.
The fan is distracting?
The fan is...
Where would her arm be if it wasn't for a fan?
Probably still attached to her.
Ba-dum-psh. Yeah.
It's distracting.
Well, to each his own. You could take your picture of a girl in a red dress and see where it comes.
That's not my thing. Unless it was a selfie.
Oh, yeah, I don't want to see that. No, that would be distracting.
Quick story about a dress.
Yeah.
Up in Portland at Pip's Original Donuts, which, as I mentioned, are fantastic. And we ordered donuts. And Nikki had ordered them, and I went to pick them up. They called us out, and Nate, the owner, he's like, "Hey, you don't look like a Nikki." And I was like, "You haven't seen me in a dress."
And what did he say?
And he said, "You come in here in a dress, and I'll give you a dozen donuts."
I would have gone and found a dress.
Yeah, so it was kind of funny. They have these mugs, and I messaged him yesterday and said, "Hey, did you get your mugs in?" And he's like, and he said, "Oh, no, I ordered them. They'll be in a couple of weeks." And he said, "By the way, have you picked out a dress yet?"
Well, you went back there multiple times on a trip?
No, just once. Oh, okay. This was on Facebook. I sent him a message because I want to buy one of these mugs. They're really neat. They're like these little diner mugs. They're kind of cool.
Wait, what's a diner? What's specific about a diner
mug? Like the shape of it. It's just like this sort of vintagey looking. They're just very classic silhouette to these mugs. Okay. And they've got the big Pip's Original logo on them.
I'm going to have to, is this a Portland only, or is it like Northwest?
Only. Okay. Only. No, just Pips.
Are you a big donut fan?
I am of these. They're little. Okay. Like these little donuts, they dredge them in cinnamon and sugar and then they drizzle them with Nutella.
Okay. See that? Yeah, I'm out.
Or honey or whatever.
You know, there's a friend of ours came over a couple weeks ago and she brought dessert over to dinner and she picked up cookies from this new place in my neighborhood. And it's like they're slightly undercooked, so they're still gooey in the middle, and they put just a little bit of salt on all their cookies so that they have like that sweet sugar thing.
Yeah, yeah, it brings out the taste.
In
2
weeks we've been there like 6 times to get cookies.
Nice. And what is this place called?
Called the Buttercream Bakery, Buttermilk Bakery, something like that. Huh. It's dangerous.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the cookies are $2.50 for like a medium sized cookie. And it's like, ugh. Anyway.
Worth it.
They even have a flax and sunflower seed one.
No.
Yeah. But here's the thing. It tastes like an oatmeal cookie. It's amazing. And I don't even like that
things
kind of stuff.
You put in bird cages.
No, that's the thing. I hate that stuff. And this thing is delicious. I mean, I'm sure they use like, you know, 6.5 gallons of molasses per cookie to make it work.
To offset it.
Yeah. But they're delicious. Anyway, it just goes to show you, you get stuck on these things. Hey, let's talk about our sponsor this week, which of course would be Squarespace.
Squarespace?
Hey, Jeffrey, are you aware that Squarespace is an all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store?
I have heard tell of this very thing.
Really? You know, for a free trial and 10% off, you can visit squarespace.com and enter the offer code FIRSTCAMERA, all one word.
FIRSTCAMERA, which would be a Pentax Super Program.
Is that what you're... I was going to ask you about that.
That was my first SLR, Pentax Super Program, purchased at Frank's in Highland Park, California, with my grandfather and I.
Mine was a Pentax K1000.
Ah, okay.
Purchased at Adorama, used with my friend Jeremy Kyman. Afterwards, he sat me down at a restaurant and showed me how aperture and shutter speed worked, and that was about 12 years ago.
Nice.
Anyway.
So plus one for Pentax.
There you go. A better website, a better web starts with your website. And, you know, I've been using Squarespace now for a few months on my own personal website. And it's funny because my new representative was over the other day and she's like, oh, I need you to move this or take this over here. And I went bloop, 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 bloop. Okay. Yeah. Anything else you need? Done. She's like, wait, you did it already? I was like, yeah, it's done. And she was very impressed. Of course.
Theme of the week?
Yeah.
Bedford.
You like Bedford?
I like this one. Yeah.
All right.
Bedford.
Bedford's not really a portfolio theme, though, right? It's more of a... Is that true or not true?
Well, you could put a... Yeah, no, you can do okay. that. I mean, it's I would say it's probably more of a blog theme, but
yeah.
because they've got the modules in the
you
new,
put anything
the
you
new
want.
Thing, the new... What do they call that?
That layout would be Layout Engine. Engine 2, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, it's simple and easy. It's got beautiful designs. I use Wexley. Jeffrey apparently would use Bedford. Drag and drop content. I do love the idea that I can just, you know, they're like, oh, you want to add pictures? Just drag a pile of pictures onto this spot in the window and it just adds them all, you know?
Oh, here's a great photographer. It's like Captain Malin using Bedford. So yeah, you can use it for photography.
Right,
big
send
full screen images. Gorgeous.
24/7 support through live chat and email, located in New York City and Dublin now, apparently. Apparently the bear care layer has spread to Dublin.
Nice.
Yeah.
They just went for the beer.
Yeah, probably. Plans start at just $8 a month and include a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And of course, you know, your sites will always look good because they're responsive. So you put them on Jeffrey's new iPad or your phone or whatever. They're always going to look good because they shrink all the way down. They have commerce, an online store. Every single site comes with an online store. You know, I think with the $8 plan, you get like one thing you can sell, 16, you can sell a half, you know, a dozen or whatever it is. And then, you know, you get unlimited later on. And you can start with a trial, no credit card required. Start building your website today. Look, go play with it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cause you know, you could import all your stuff from WordPress and stuff. You could connect to your Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, LinkedIn, Instagram, Google accounts and all that kind of stuff. You know,
social media.
You know, and so when you decide to sign up, go make sure you use the offer code FIRSTCAMERA. You know what? Our next one should be Pentax to get 10% off your first purchase.
That. Alan's head would explode.
I know. to show your support for On Taking Pictures. So thank you very much to Squarespace for supporting 5x5 and On Taking Pictures. Squarespace, a better web starts with your website.
Yeah, and go check out some of their templates, man. This Bedford thing, I'm loving this.
Captain Mallon.
Yeah. And this other thing, the Wayfarers, this husband and wife photo team.
Oh, yeah, this is nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
And the Wayfarers.co.
Anyway, the Wayfarers, yeah. I wonder if they wear Wayfarers.
Is .co, is it company? Is that what that is?
I don't know.
I was wondering
Columbia?
About that.
Maybe it's .columbia.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I wonder if it's or Colorado.
Cartel.
Yeah. Yeah. Enjoy buying that domain that supports. It's good stuff. So, yeah.
Jackbooted thugs will be at your home.
Apparently. All right. What's next? What else we got?
What's next? Hey, you know what? If there is a hell, if there is a hell
yeah.
for you, Bill Wadman,
yeah.
I have found the job which you will perform in that hell.
All right, give it to me.
W Hotels now offering a social media wedding concierge who will tweet, Instagram, Vine, blog, and Facebook your wedding. So that is going to be your... So you clean up your act, Wadman, or so help me, you're going to spend an eternity photographing.
I'm sorry you can't hear me because my head is in my hands.
Wow. And wait. Did you tell them how much it costs?
Yeah, prices start at $3,000.
Come on, son.
Come on, son.
$3,000?
Yeah.
For an afternoon of somebody tweeting?
Running until the end of the year, the deal, which is being offered to those tying the knot.
It's a special. It's a time-limited special for
$3,000. Get in while you can.
Yeah.
Four W Hotels in New York offer the services of a social media expert, which they put in quotes in this article.
AKA anybody under the age of 30.
From live tweets and hashtags to Vine videos, Instagram filters, W's social media wedding concierge will document the I do's and encourage guests to utilize dedicated wedding hashtag for every one of their posts, the hotel chain says.
How do you feel about this? Is this the market economy doing what the market economy should do?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this. I mean, you know, good on them. If that's what you want. I mean, look, people are going to love this. I mean, if people can get married in, you know, Star Wars costumes on a roller coaster, then why is having somebody tweet it such a stretch, I guess? I don't know.
I guess it cracks me up, first of all, that if you're having a wedding and there's guests there, they're probably going to be tweeting and Instagramming and Vining and blogging and Facebooking during the wedding anyway.
Right. Yeah, maybe that's what you say. You say, hey, you know, hashtag Smith wedding or whatever it is. Everybody who's here, do your thing.
Yeah. I remember going to a wedding and what they did was they had a laptop by the door and they're just like, look, if you took pictures during the wedding, just stick the card in and dump them on here.
I've only ever been to one wedding.
In your life?
Yes.
How's that possible?
Because I don't go to weddings.
Oh, you get invited and then say no?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lucky bastard.
I've been to one wedding and one funeral.
Wow.
Yeah.
In a related article that I read this morning, apparently the new thing is birth photographers.
That's not new. Is that new?
Apparently, like, you know, people being in the delivery room taking pictures for you, not like the dad, but, you know, somebody else.
Okay.
That would be interesting. I almost did that with one of my 365 portraits people.
There's where you need 4K right there.
Yeah, exactly. I just, you know, yeah, I would. I mean, that would actually be interesting to me in some crazy way.
Nope.
The circle of life.
Yeah.
And the photographer like lifts up the baby.
That's right.
Did you see
cue the boombox? Cue the boombox.
Did you see that that Frozen movie is now the biggest animated movie of all time?
I haven't seen it. I haven't seen the movie. I understand it's cute. I don't like the song really that got all the acclaim.
The song that got the acclaim I don't like at all, but there are two songs towards the beginning of the movie that are actually really adorable.
But that one by Adele Dazeem.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? Here's the problem, though. They bring her in, and she's like a really well-known, you know, she was on Glee as Rachel's mom, if you watch Glee, the one that does the singing. She's like a fairly famous, like, Broadway person, right?
Okay.
And it's fine, and she's, you know, she's obviously got an amazing voice and all the rest of it. But A, she's a little too old, because she's like probably 40-something, you know, playing the role of a 20-something, you know, whatever.
Wait, she's somebody's mom and she's somebody's mom in high school and she's only supposed to be 20?
No, I'm saying on Glee, she's somebody's mom who's in high school, but in Frozen, she plays a character who's like young.
Oh, okay.
You know,
wait, isn't it? I thought it was animated.
It is, but she does the voice of, you know, whatever. Oh, okay. And but you okay. can hear, you know what I mean? It's like a little too mature of a voice, you know, for my ear. Like I could feel like she was older. And she's
so she's no E.G. Daily.
No, and she's such a good singer, and she's an excellent singer that she's almost too good of a singer. I tend to like my animated movies where the people aren't like amazing singers. It almost you could almost imagine the character actually singing the song versus it being obvious that they brought in a singer to sing the song, you know, that kind of thing.
Okay.
Like, cause, what's her name? Who's the cute one from Veronica Mars?
I don't watch
Kristen Bell is the other girl in the movie.
Okay.
And she sings her parts too. And of course, Kristen Bell can sing, cause any of those like actor people, they can all, you know, sing a little bit cause they've been doing it since they were kids. You know, they're all like in drama club and stuff.
Okay.
And, she sings the songs and I mean, she's a fine singer, you know, I mean, for her, she sounds great. You know, she's just some actress who sings. But I almost believed her character more because her singing wasn't over the top. You know what I mean? Like it wasn't distracting that she was singing. It was like, oh, she's just singing the song because okay. she's the character. And I just think it was interesting casting, bringing in this like super high end Broadway girl for the one girl and then just having Kristen Bell sing the other one. It felt like a little bit disparate. Not what I would have done if I was casting. Anyway, you should go see the Frozen. It was fun.
So wait, she plays the blonde-haired girl in the poster here?
There's an older sister and a younger sister. Let me see. Frozen poster.
From the creators of Tangled and Wreck-It Ralph. I liked Wreck-It Ralph. That was pretty funny.
Yes, Wreck-It Ralph was cute. The super Broadway girl plays the blonde girl, and the one hanging on to the guy on the reindeer is played by Kristen Bell, who's actually, in many ways, she's the protagonist, the one in the pink dress. Which is just kind of funny that they have her like that in the pictures.
I like the big ice monster, Marshmallow.
Yeah, his name is Marshmallow. He's pretty scary. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know how he got on that.
I don't know. Another movie we should probably mention, Finding Vivian Mayer is screening now.
Yeah, it's playing at the IFC Center in someplace uptown.
I didn't get a chance to go when it was here over the weekend. Barrio Next went and Patrick went.
And what'd they say?
Barry Next said it was great. I haven't talked to Patrick, but there was a Q&A with the director, one of the directors.
You know, I heard sent us an email with a podcast interview with the directors.
The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell.
Yes, right. Yeah, because it was Elvis Mitchell, right?
Yeah, KCRW.
Did you listen to it?
I did.
Okay. I think it's interesting that the story is literally about his process of finding her. Like they're doing it from the perspective of his search, the sort of the detective story of finding
it. It's a mystery. They're uncovering all of this stuff rather than a narrative of her life.
Right. And I like that from an artistic point of view, but I also feel like, I don't know, there's something about this whole Vivian Mayer thing that feels like the people who found the pictures are taking too much credit for themselves. You know, for having found the pictures, you know,
I did think it was kind of funny that, you know, he's like, oh yeah. And I carry a camera with me everywhere I go now. And I'm blah, 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 blah. And it's like, well, okay, but this isn't about you.
Right. Well, that's exactly my point. And a lot of the interviews and things that I've seen about the movie have kind of had that feel to them. Like it's the story of the guy finding the box as much as it is the pictures. And it's kind of like, okay, but he's just some guy who bought some pictures. Like suddenly like he's the star. Like,
right.
You know?
Right. Yeah, it was very sort of happenstance. He bought the first box for $380, something like that. And, you know, thought they were interesting and then went and bought other boxes from other people. And then
he had to go buy the other ones and, oh yeah, I want your pictures. Well, why do you want these? I don't know. I just really like them. Yeah. I'm not going to make millions and millions of dollars on them.
I wonder what kind of, what has been generated from, I mean, what has he spent scanning all, you know, 100,000
that book
plus.
Has sold a lot of copies, right?
Yeah. The book, well, there are a couple of books now. There's the film. I mean, I know that when this first kind of broke, they did a show at the Karnowski Gallery in LA that we went to and, you know, the actor Tim Roth, he was big in getting this to light. He bought a lot of the original, you know, the first series of prints and whatnot, and was kind of a big proponent of getting the word out with Maloof. And they're very nice. They're very nice photographs.
Yeah.
You know, and this is kind of something. I don't know, this in a weird way, it gets us back to the earlier discussion about, you know, she just kind of had it. She started taking pictures, from what we gather, late in life, and she just had an eye.
Well, we are also seeing a very select. We're seeing how many he has, like 40,000 images.
100,000.
Right. And we've seen how many pictures? Maybe a couple hundred.
Right.
So, you know, like, we're also not seeing everything, you know.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you know, and she shot a lot. You know, there was a question in the interview where they talk about whether she wanted the pictures to be seen. And their argument was, well, she paid to keep up her storage lockers full of the pictures. And we have this right. one letter where she mentioned that she liked the pictures or something like that, you know, and well, we take that as the letter, they want to be seen.
There's the letter where she was trying to get postcards printed.
Yeah. But
well, if you're going to the trouble to send your work to another country to be processed and printed yeah. as postcards, don't you want them to be seen?
Well, maybe she didn't want to sell postcards. Maybe she just wanted to get postcards of the pictures to send to her friends or something. You know what I mean? We don't know.
Seems like an awful lot of trouble to go through.
Well, maybe. Yeah. But I just think that that's a bit of an extrapolation to say that, oh, therefore she wanted it everywhere on social media, you know?
But it's always the social media with you. Well, social media is the thorn in your side.
No, it's just, you know, it's the thorn in society's side.
If you were Jesus, social media would be
my crown.
Spear.
Oh, it would be the spear. Okay.
Yeah. Piercing your side.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting. I can't wait to, I'm going to see the movie. I was going to go see it on Friday and something came up, but yeah, maybe, you know, we should talk to some people, see if we can get a copy. But it's, you know, it's interesting. I do. It does niggle me a little bit, though, that like it seems to be about the guy as much as it is about her. And it's just kind of like, yeah, you know, great. Good job buying those boxes at a sale. You know,
I don't know. I'm going to reserve anything because I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated by the stories on both sides. Yeah. I'm fascinated by. The buying of them. I mean, look, how many people have you know, ended up buying negatives or prints or whatever and look at them and didn't have, maybe there's another Vivian. There probably are several Vivian Mayers out there, but, you know, bravo to him for recognizing something in these photographs that needed to be seen.
Yep.
And, sure. and going into the motion.
Okay, well, hold on a second. Needed to be seen?
Sure. People have gotten enjoyment out of them. They need it's bringing, you know, happiness and joy. Not everybody's looking at them as an investment.
No. I know. I felt like that was sort of a judgment that said that like it would be a crime if these weren't shared.
But how is that any different than the curator at MoMA saying this needs to be seen? I need to share this work with the world. Same thing.
I guess it's not, except for the fact that
you needing to show people your red dress.
I guess my part of it, and I am very much along the lines of somebody who, you know, art should be shared with the world, or else like you should show it to other people, or else it's not really worth it. Or you know, like just making it and sticking it in a box is missing half the fun.
Yeah, I mean that's.
But at the same time, I don't necessarily know that she wanted all of this. If she was alive, if she would be upset about it, you know?
But you could argue the same thing about Saul. Did he?
Sure.
He didn't want that. He didn't want to be famous and hounded. He just wanted to take pictures.
Right, but Saul also had a choice in the matter. She didn't. You know what I mean?
Well, then it just becomes speculation.
Well, yeah, of course.
I'm glad that her work has been brought to light. I'm glad that it's being shown. I think it's inspiring for me. I think it's inspiring to a number of other people. And you know, if John wants to get a little juice out of it, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like he should. Well, she didn't have kids or anything like that, right?
I don't think so.
I wonder how does that work? Because theoretically, her estate would own. I wonder how that works, or if she just forfeits all rights to the copyright. When did she die?
I don't know.
You know, I wonder if like somebody's due money. You know what I mean? That's an interesting question. We'll have to figure it out. Hey, so we talked about that Hasselblad that got sold last week.
Yes.
Which the owners said was from the moon, from Apollo 15.
It wasn't, though.
But it's odd that it would have been brought back, because as they say, they left all the rest of them on the moon. Why would they have brought this one back?
Friend of the show, Carl Taylor, called me and said, this is bollocks, basically, that it didn't go to the moon.
Yeah.
He talked to Hasselblad. He talked to, like, the guy at Hasselblad who would know, and he said, no, this didn't go to the moon.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes from vice.com, motherboard.vice.com. Mm-hmm. And they talk about how, like, Ed Mitchell brought back the 16 millimeter camera that's in the windows of the LEM, that, you know, and he's getting in trouble for trying to sell it years later, even though they let him have it, because technically it's still government property and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it talks about, like, the definition of an artifact and what the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo people could do that the later shuttle people couldn't do. Anyway, they show one of these 70 millimeter Hasselblad 500s that they built for this thing. And apparently part of the argument that this thing is the real one is that there's a Rousseau plate, which is a plate that goes right in front of the film in these cameras specialty that imparts those, like, X's, you know, those little X's that are all over. Okay. So those are there for a reason, because they allow you to do all kinds of measurements and figure out distances and stuff based upon like angles and, you know, all this kind of, like, crazy. What is the term when you do this, like, image analytics stuff, whatever it is. Anyway, so the Rousseau plates themselves have numbers on them. They're, like, each sort of serial numbered. And the one in this camera, in the auction camera, is number 38, which was there was a Rousseau plate with the number 38 in it inside one of the Apollo 15 cameras. However, the 38 looks slightly different on the pictures versus the one that's on the plate. And some people are saying, yeah, it says 38, but that's not the same. It's not the same plate that they could have replaced. So basically, not only is it a fraud, but it's essentially a forgery.
Right.
Which is just crazy.
Yeah. When Carl was talking to the guy from Hasselblad, he said that, you know, Hasselblad made a bunch of them. He said, best case scenario, it could have gone around the moon.
Yep.
But he said probably the more likely thing is it was one of the training cameras that they used back here on Earth, because they made multiple copies.
Of course, they needed
tons of them. And if somebody's having a problem on the moon, they can have a guy on Earth holding the same thing and go, okay, well, here's what you want to do, kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, they had lots of things. And yeah, if it was up in the command module, then yeah, it could be one of those. But again, that one wouldn't have this 38 Rousseau plate, you know what I mean? Whatever it is.
And if you look at the plates, they do look different.
Yeah, it doesn't line the letter numbers don't line up or, like, look the right way.
No, they don't.
Because those are all, like, hand etched. Do you see how it's, like, actually scraped in?
Yeah, that's fantastic.
This is old school stuff right there.
Yeah. Some guy with it.
Yeah, with a little grinder. How awesome would that be? Anyway, could you imagine being this Japanese guy who paid $1 million for the thing?
No.
Oh, he's got to be pissed.
Yeah. And what do you do if it does turn out? I mean, who do you go after? The auction house? Do you go after the seller? What do you do? What's the recourse?
Well, apparently the auctioneer produced another bit of proof ahead of the auction on Saturday, and it says it has moon dust on it.
What?
That's what he claims. Yeah.
You know, talcum powder.
Yeah, you know, Al Bean on Apollo 12, they got to keep their mission patches, you know, that were on the outside of their suits.
Okay.
And he walked on the moon, Apollo 12. He was the lunar module pilot, Apollo 12. And he's also a painter. And so when he got back and he retired and everything, he had these mission patches that had ground into them lots and lots of lunar dust, because they went out a couple times and they got to keep these patches. So he had these patches with all lunar dust on them. And he was like, you know what? Like, what happens when I die? These are going to go to my kids and they're probably going to sell them at an auction or whatever it is. He's just like, no, I don't want to do that. So he cut them up and he...
What? Like destroyed them?
Destroyed them.
Oh, wow.
And paints threads of them into his paintings.
Neato.
So if you buy an Albin painting, which, by the way, are all of Apollo astronauts on the moon.
Neat.
They have threads of moon dust and fabric from the patches in them.
How do you spell his name?
Albin, just the way you would imagine. Yeah. Albean.
Okay.
In fact, albingallery.com. I'll put a link in the show notes.
This website is out of this world.
Oh, yeah. What's up? Yeah, what's crazy is that you go there, you know, and look at, have you seen how much these things go for?
Holy moly.
Yeah.
$430,000.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
$35,000, $368,000.
Acrylic with moon dust on aircraft plywood. What a great description, though.
Yeah, right. No, not many people get to do that.
Yeah.
But look, a lot of them are sold.
Huh.
You know, people are buying.
Interesting texture on the substrate with the footprints and whatnot.
Yeah, he's got, and it's interesting. If you look back on his stuff, it's changed over the years a little bit. So anyway, it's just kind of interesting that like these guys are of a whole other time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That famous photo of Buzz Aldrin as a painting, $228,000 and it sold.
Sold. I wonder who bought it. I'm going to put a link to this in the show notes because it's pretty cool. But Albin, yeah, really, really nice guy. Played by, who's the guy from, Dave, comedian, Dave.
Coulier.
No.
Chappelle.
Cut it out.
Matthews. Dave Matthews played him.
Dave Hill. No. Who was it? In
Dave Clark Five.
From the Earth to the Moon.
Dave.
Who's in Mr. Show? No, that was Dave.
David Cross.
No, it's not David Cross. It's the other guy. Shoot. David Cross. Kids in the Hall. Who's in Kids in the Hall? That was a show, right?
Yeah, it was a Canadian.
Yeah, there you go. Dave Foley.
Oh, Dave Foley.
Dave
really?
Foley plays Albin in From the Earth to the Moon.
Oh.
The episode about Apollo 12, which is actually one of the better episodes, and that series is fantastic, but that one's super, super fantastic.
He was also in Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser.
Oh. Is that the one where they wake up underground? Or
yeah, Christopher Walken plays the dad.
Yeah, Heather... Yeah.
Sissy Spacek is the mom.
Yeah, Conrad made me watch that movie, and I was like, wow, this is really bad. I'd never seen it before.
Love me some Brendan Fraser.
Hey, I was reading the Foblographer this morning, just seeing if I missed anything in the past week.
is that where you go if you miss something?
Yeah, well, you know, everything gets on there eventually. apparently Bob Crowley, now I talked about this a little while ago. I love the Polaroid 55 instant film, right? This is 4x5 film that, gives you a negative right out of the camera. So
okay,
it's a negative and a positive, and it's like amazing, super, super finely grained, black and white film. And it disappeared. I have a few slices left, which I have to use, but
instant film though, right?
Yeah. This is 4x5 instant film. That is amazing.
Oh, this is the one actually probably my favorite photograph that you've taken is in this film. It's the guy, Heather's boss. What's his name?
That would be my sister's boss, Pino.
Not Heather's boss. Yeah. Yeah. Your sister's boss.
Yeah. Yeah. Pino.
I love that photo.
Yeah. So this stuff is really, really cool. And obviously you can't get it anymore, and boxes of it go for $400 on eBay, and they're Yeesh. All expired anyway. So, but really all it is like, you know, this chemical pack, a piece of print paper, a negative in there. And then like, you know, as with all Polaroid stuff, you expose it and then you smush the pack of chemicals across it. You wait X amount of time and you rip it open. And so this guy has started playing around with the idea of like using, say, Kodak paper and X film or whatever it is, you know, some film, mm-hmm. and basically hand creating a new version of 55, which he calls New 55. And
wow, and he's building every sheet by hand?
Well, he did a lot of the test ones by hand. He's now trying to raise $400,000 to do it for real, like to get it manufactured. And for $75, you can buy a box, which gives you five pictures for $75
which seems reasonable.
Well, you know, it's
or
it
you could buy
40 piece?
Memory cards.
Well, yeah, but this is a very hey authenticity.
I'm kidding.
Yeah,
I'm
but,
kidding.
But Jeffrey,
I'm
this
kidding.
Is authentic. So, yeah. So anyway, it's just, but it's pretty cool that this guy's actually trying to do this, and if he actually is able to
neat,
do
it, actually,
yeah. And
you'd think that he would team up with Impossible with those guys.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. There was some talk of the machines that made this stuff were in Waltham originally, like the,
okay.
And I'm surprised that he didn't somehow, I think he contacted some people, but like he couldn't get the machines or the machines. I think the big problem was getting the chemicals right or something like that. Anyway, long story short,
is the formula public knowledge? I mean, or is that
no?
Is that,
that was
IP.
That was all Polaroid intellectual property. So I think he worked with this for a long, long time to try to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, he's like the pod is the critical component. It has to be sealed, and yet it also has to burst in the right direction with just the right amount of pressure. As of writing, 20 by 24 is offering to produce these for us at a per unit cost. So the people who make the ones that, what's his name used recently for those
Chuck Close
used for the Vanity Fair pictures, they're going to make the pods for them because they have tons of the chemicals. Hmm. So what's crazy is that like,
do they have the ability to make more, or is this a finite amount, finite supply of chemistry?
I don't know, because the pod contains developer fixer, solvent thickener, and toners, along with pH boosting ingredients needed for rapid diffusion transfer reversal to take place. Like, you know, for so many years, we all had, you know, I had these boxes of Polaroid 55, and I would shoot $5 a shot or whatever they were at the time, right? And not realizing how much stuff was in there, you know what I mean?
Right,
and how much
right.
got lost when Polaroid went belly up.
Hmm.
You know, you got to think also how much could possibly go if Kodak stops making film, like how much knowledge just gets thrown down the trash, you know?
Right.
We were talking about this last night where one of the Taylor dancers was over for dinner. And I said, you know, it's amazing to me. This guy has been putting on dances for 60 years and you guys have footage or video of a lot of it and you have a lot of it digitized. Why not like create a YouTube channel and have it all up there so people can see it? You know, this guy's not going to be around forever. And, you know, if that place burns down, you don't have backups. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And it's like it's...
There's got to be some amazing archival footage there.
Oh, amazing stuff. That
interviews.
Right. That may never see the light of day because of, you know, copyright questions and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Hey, you know who he was friends with?
Yeah, Rauschenberg. Did you... Oh, Rauschenberg. That's... I was going to bring that up. So Paul announced a couple weeks ago that they're actually sort of... He's morphing the company or starting a new one with some of the same people and stuff where they're going to start doing all kinds of modern dance from all the masters of modern dance, sort of more a conservatory kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And one of the ways he's going to fund it is by selling multiple Rauschenbergs that Rauschenberg gave him.
Wow.
$10 million worth of paintings.
Oh my gosh.
So what we need to do, Jeffrey, is not be successful ourselves, but become friends with people who are going to be famous painters in 50 years and just have them give us stuff.
That's right.
So I hope you're working on that.
I'm working on that. I'm going to get people on the group to send me prints. And
that's a good idea.
Signed prints.
That's a good idea.
Actually, there are a lot of people on there whose prints I would like.
Well, you should.
And you know who you are.
You should be nice and ask for some.
Yeah.
Hey, so anyway, last thing, Kickstarter. So they're looking for 400 grand. They've got 80 grand, but there's 34 days to go. It's annoying. I'm considering, I want to help support it, but like $75 for 5 pictures is a lot. So anyway, if you're into this kind of thing or know anybody who is, let them know. Cause I would love to see this survive and I may actually do it myself. It's pretty cool stuff. So
yeah.
I'll put the link in the show notes, New 55. You know, he's been talking about this for years. There's a website about it for years that they've been doing tests and stuff. And everyone's like, when are you going to actually start making it? And it's always like, oh, next week, next month, next year.
Right.
And he's finally actually doing it for real. He must have gotten some people to put some money in or something, you know, to kickstart it, as it were.
Huh.
Maybe he'll sell it for $2 billion in a week and a half and we'll all not get our film.
Like WhatsApp or something? Or Oculus?
Oculus.
Yeah. Whatever. I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's.
No, I don't think it's a bad thing. But if I were the owner of Oculus Rift and I only was able to gotten where I was because a whole bunch of people gave like money, I would say, you know what? I'm going to give your money back times two, you know, and you'll all get a free Oculus Rift when we're done with this thing. You know, when we get it all like, I don't know. I'd be that guy. You know, I'd want to pay it backwards or pay it forwards, pay it. You know what I mean?
Right.
I would want to make a statement that says, you know what? We're about more than just everyone getting exactly how many cents there were on the ledger from legal reasons. You guys were supporters of this when a lot of people weren't. We're going to make it right. You know, I don't know. I just think there's something to that. Maybe I'm, what's it called? Naive. Who's our photographer of the week? You chose this one today.
Photographer of the week. Lee Friedlander.
I'm surprised we hadn't done that again yet.
Really, really interesting stuff. Born in 1934, started shooting in 1948.
Yep.
So he's been around a long time. Been doing a lot of really, really great stuff. Recognized for a group of self-portraits he began in the 60s, reproduced in a book called Self-Portrait. I really like this guy's stuff. And again, it's partially the photographs themselves, but it's also partially the time in which he photographs.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, you could say like, you know, Meyerowitz's stuff is really good now, but there's a different aesthetic to, you know, 60s, 70s than there is now, even though the vision or the eye may be consistent.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. Now, do you think that's just a matter of waiting for our pictures to be cool?
I don't think my pictures are ever going to be
cool.
You
know what I mean? Is it a matter of waiting for...
Well, every generation looks at the previous generation with fondness.
Yeah.
And that's happened...
Or disdain.
You know, or yeah, but I mean, you know, the people, you know, oh, the 40s were so much better than the 50s and the, you know, the 80s were so, well, the 80s are pretty awesome. But anyway, you look back.
The 80s, so there
really, I love the 80s, but I also love the 70s.
Well, you know, it was a lot of great music, your life.
A lot of great music, a lot of great cinema came out of the 70s.
Yeah.
Pacino did his best work. Nicholson did his best work.
Yeah. But other actors did their best work in the 90s or the 60s. You know?
True. Anyway, so yeah, really great stuff. A lot of, how would you even say it? Almost mundane photographs, but I find them very interesting. Workplace photographs.
A lot. You know? He does that whole car thing a lot too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
you know, shooting mm-hmm. out of the car window.
Which I think is an interesting framing device.
Yeah, it is. It's funny though. It's when it's older cars, it's somehow more interesting to me than the newer cars. But I guess that's our own bias too, you know.
Yeah. Well, I miss cars with wind wings.
Yeah. Wait, what Remember are those?
Wind wings. The little triangular shape pieces of glass in the front.
Oh,
of the,
you like that?
I love those. Yeah. In fact, I posted on Twitter. I saw a beautiful 2002 at the Clatch, my local coffee place that I go to. This sort of British racing green, beautifully restored 74 2002. Gorgeous
this is
car.
BMW?
BMW, yeah, yeah. Made me miss mine.
You should go get one of those.
I would love to. I saw a really beautiful one. All California car, completely restored, 26,000.
Do you think it's funny because he's got a lot of pictures in here that are... you know, the reflections in glass, the sort of, you know, windows,
mm-hmm,
Ache-ish mm-hmm. kind of stuff.
Sure.
He's got stuff that kind of feels like black and white versions of Eggleston stuff in here. I'm not saying that he's copying those people. I'm just saying it's interesting how there's threads of different time periods, you know?
I agree. I think he's covering a lot of sort of stylistic ground.
Yeah.
You know, there's even, I don't know. You have to look for what's interesting in his work. I think it's not readily apparent.
Yeah. He's definitely one of those photographers. You got to spend some time with each image.
Yeah. And I like that. I like that quite a bit. I like having to kind of sit and go, well, do I find anything really intriguing about this? You know, especially the mannequin pieces. I mean, on the surface, it's like, oh, he looks like he's walking down the street and he just happened to shoot some mannequins. But on closer look, I think there's something interesting there.
Yeah.
You know, the sign, the sort of triangle yield sign with the clouds, you know, framed just so on top of it. So it looks kind of like an ice cream cone. You know, it's a great perspective. Then he's got another one taken in Vegas where you've got the Luxor Pyramid, you know, sort of butting up against the point of a yield sign. So there's just some interesting geometry happening in some of his work.
Yeah, foreground, background stuff.
Yeah, and it just shows, I think anyway, it shows an attention to detail that meant something to him regardless of whether it means something to us as the viewer. He connected with it.
Yeah. See, you know, that kind of stuff, I could totally see my, if I was walking around with the camera a lot of times, that's the kind of stuff I would end up taking.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, it's those little details. There's another photographer that, Rinzi Ruiz, do you know this guy?
No.
LA photographer. Really interesting stuff. Ibarra next turned me on to him, and
I'm looking now.
Here.
I'm looking.
There you go.
I got it.
Okay. Really interesting. A lot of shadows. Really crushes the blacks, but there's pattern in there, and there are little details that maybe aren't readily apparent. And I see that in Friedlander's work as well. You know, some of it is overt, some of it's out there for you, but some of it, particularly his building pictures and you know, buses and things like that, where they on the surface look mundane, but then when you really look at them, there's something interesting there. And I like that about his work as well.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Why this week for this guy? Did you bump into some of his stuff, or did you just been thinking about it?
I think maybe Portland had something to do with it. You know, spending a lot of time in the downtown area of Portland, and then going to the east side of the river where it's very different. You know, it's a very different landscape than the buildings and the concrete of downtown Portland.
Right.
And it just got me thinking about street stuff and shooting where you live and finding interest in where it is that you live, you know, photographically.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what's sparked it. Something.
Good stuff. Lee Friedlander.
Yeah, Lee Friedlander. Hey, can I say something before we wrap up?
Sure.
I've been thinking about a project, and I wanted to say something about it last week, and it still hasn't. All the pieces haven't lined up yet, but I think it's worth pursuing. And that is, I'd like to do a book of photos from the group.
Okay.
I'd like to be on Taking Pictures 100, 100 photographs from the group, and intermixed with that sort of transcribed versions of some of our favorite and some of the listeners' favorite bits from the past 100 shows.
Okay.
The problem is printing. A lot of the printers in China, they have pretty large minimums. I'm not really thrilled with the cost quality Venn diagram of blurb. Lightning Source is interesting, although they don't offer a really nice glossy stock. It's more of a it's not matte, but it's not semi-gloss. It's somewhere between. It's sort of a half matte.
It's more like, you know, like a magazine kind of gloss, isn't it?
Similar,
like
not
a little waxy. Almost.
Yeah, it's a little. It's fine quality.
Have you actually got test stuff done?
I do. I've gotten. They've sent me some sample books.
Okay.
Which are not bad. I had somebody up in Seattle, a printer, quote me a price. But the thing that I would like to do, I'd like to do 100 limited edition hardcovers, and then you know, a run of soft covers. But along with the hardcover books, we would print out 8x10s of each 100 photos that are in the book, and include one of the photos. So you get a random print from someone with the limited edition.
The limited edition ones. Good idea.
Which I think would be really interesting.
Yeah.
So this is still kind of in the works, but it's something that I'm trying to figure out. You know, so you know, ping us at the group or you know, at Bill Wadman or at Jeffrey Sidoris, and let me know what you think. Is it worth pursuing? Do you guys think it would be interesting? It would be this sort of community curated kind of project, and I think it's interesting. And there's just so much great work that's being shared that I'd like to somehow celebrate that and mark it somehow with an object.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. Let's see if we can do it.
That's it.
So what are you asking these people to do right now?
Is it something that you'd like to pursue? Because obviously, okay. We're going to need photos when the time comes. Right now, I'm still in sort of print research mode of trying to find a way to do 100-unit hardcover run that's not, you know, $97 a copy.
Right. Okay.
Because that's just silly to me.
Okay.
You know, if we can keep the end user cost to in the $50 to $60 range and make enough to cover, you know, manufacturing and all that kind of stuff, I think that would be interesting to do. So that's kind of where it's at.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. So, hey, Bill.
Anything else we need to do before we wrap up?
Where do people get a hold of us? See, you always ask me that.
Let's see. Jeffrey's on Twitter at Jeffrey Sidoris, JeffreySadoris. He's at fadedandblurred.com. You still have Sidoris.com?
It's still there. There's not much there at the moment. I've been toying with starting kind of a personal blog. Have you enjoyed it? Have you enjoyed doing yours since you've moved it to your site and not?
I mean, it's the same tone and content as the old thing. So yeah, sure. You know, I mean, I do it when I have time and something comes up, but I am not.
Is it a chore? Has it become a chore, or do you still? I'm afraid that it would feel like I have to do it.
I don't write when I don't feel like writing. So
okay,
but that's
kind of where I'm at.
But there's also the argument to be said that, like, well, then people won't keep coming if you don't have something there every day, and then it becomes a job, and it's like, well, I don't want my job to be blogging. So you know,
right?
So you know, these are all the questions we always ask. But I come down on the side of, you know, I write when there's something I feel like I want to write, and when there's not, I have other things to do. I will do those other things because I'm not going to sit on my deathbed and say, you know, I didn't write enough blog posts.
Right.
So
I guess I'm just wondering if it's worth having another venue, or if I should just add a personal blog post every once in a while to Faded and Blurred.
Kind of
like I did one the other day on, what was I yammering on about? What was that? Oh, playing the long game. Struggling with success and failure.
Sure.
You know, that was more of a personal post than the stuff that we usually put on Faded and Blurred, but people seem to like it. So maybe every once in a while I'll just start posting stuff there.
It would get noticed more on Faded and Blurred, right? Technically?
Yeah. Yeah. I just like to get it out. I'm not really worried about the notice. I just want to get it out of my head so I can stop thinking about these things.
I gotcha. Let's see. I'm at BillWadman.com and I'm at Bill Wadman on Twitter. Very imaginative. And, what's the phone number if somebody wants to send us a voicemail?
You want to send a voicemail? You go to 347-687-9411, 347-687-9411.
Okay. And, we will see you next week. I think we're going to try to do a Q&A next week. So I'm going to put out a quick post after this to round up some questions, because Q&As are always fun.
And you, and wait, real quick.
Yeah.
You're doing a meetup in Seattle? What are you doing?
Yeah, okay. So I think the current plan, and I'm waiting to hear back from one other person who has nothing to do with the meetup, but I may have to shoot on Tuesday.
Okay.
The plan is to meet up, I think, on Tuesday, probably late afternoon, somewhere downtown Oregon. And I think Mark...
Wait, downtown Oregon?
I'm sorry, Seattle. I was thinking Oregon. Downtown Seattle.
You're going to have a bunch of people, you know, lining up, and you won't be there.
Yeah, Mike Waller, I think it is, on the group.
Okay.
Has suggested a couple places which both seem fine and are close to the hotel I have to stay at. So, I think we're going to do Tuesday. Tuesday, you know, late afternoon into evening, just hang out, eat some food, drink, talk, whatever.
Now, are you doing any sort of photo walkie type of thing, or what are you doing? No, okay,
not really my thing.
Okay,
but I, you know, I think we'll have a good discussion. Hey, if no one shows up, that'll be fine. You know, I will sit and eat food, Seattle food. I think Bellward's coming down. So
from Vancouver,
yeah. Well, it's a 2.5 hour drive, I think. Bellward says he's coming down. Right? Well, that's why I'm doing it in a public place. So yeah, so I will put some stuff on the group and I will tweet. So if you want to be interested in that, I think Tuesday downtown Seattle, I will put up details once we figure them out.
Nice.
And it should be fun.
I'm excited for you.
Yeah, it should be a good time.
Yeah, it's gonna be great.
The big
question: Have you bought a new camera to sell when you get back?
Womp, 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 womp.
You see what I did there?
Yeah. No, I have not.
Okay, so but you're bringing a camera.
I haven't
right?
bought a camera in 5 years. I bought two cameras last year, neither of which I really liked.
Are you bringing your 5D?
Yeah, I got to bring my 5D because I'm meeting up with an author that I like a lot.
So you want to keep that hidden until you get back, or you want to share?
Yeah, no, I'll keep it hidden.
Okay,
see right. if it happens.
All right,
should be fun, and we'll see you in 2 weeks to do a new one of these. But we're going to do a Q&A, I think probably before I leave, and we'll put it up next week.
Yeah, cool.
Okay,
so get your questions in.
Yep,
submit them either in the group or to
Twitter
one of
to
us.
Yeah,
email us podcast at ontakingpictures.com.
Yep.
Yeah, I love the Q&A shows.
Yeah,
those are fun.
Anything else?
Nope, that's it.
All right.
All right, have a good week, everyone. Thanks for listening.
See
ya. We'll see you next week.
Yep.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say.